KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Israelis are understandably unnerved by this approach from President Trump, which is quite different from his approach toward Israel in his first term.
President Trump made a three-nation trip through the Middle East, but left the region without a stop in Israel.
For Friday, May 16th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. This hour, Dick's Sporting Goods is buying the struggling footwear chain Foot Locker.
We're pretty conservative. We don't get over our skis. We took a long time to think about this.
Also, the head of Venezuela's opposition is calling for a boycott of regional elections this month.
And 25 years after the premiere of Final Destination, the franchise is back with its sixth installment.
The real fear from Final Destination comes from our anxieties. You know, that little nagging voice in your head that says, maybe it's not a good idea to get on that plane.
Plus, there's a new Rubik's Cube record. It is faster than you can blink.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. The Supreme Court has ruled the Trump administration will not be allowed to deport a group of Venezuelans while their case is being litigated in the courts. Justices today blocking Trump from deporting people under the Alien Enemies Act and sending the matter back to a federal appeals court. Justices acted on an emergency appeal to a request from the Trump administration to be allowed to quickly resume the fast-track deportations of Venezuelans suspected of being gang members. High Court had already called for a temporary halt to those deportations. Two justices, Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas, dissented. China is criticizing new American export controls on semiconductor chips, calling it, quote, abuse. The controls impact one of China's most important artificial intelligence chips just days after a temporary trade truce. Here's NPR's Emily Fang.
The export controls prohibit the export of several kinds of AI computing chips from the Chinese company Huawei. The U.S. says it can control these chips because they use a bit of American technology and how they were made and designed. And the U.S. publicized the new controls the same week President Trump announced the UAE and the U.S. would jointly build a huge AI data center in the Middle East. China's foreign ministry said the measures on Huawei were, quote, protectionism and unilateral bullying. Huawei has been hit hard by U.S. export controls before over its 5G telecom networks and has since pivoted to technologies like semiconductor chips and is even exploring building its own chip factories. Emily Fang, NPR News.
President Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Bill appears to have hit a major bump in the road for GOP fiscal conservatives moving to block the package of tax breaks and spending cuts out of committee. They want further cuts to Medicaid and green energy programs as lawmakers look to find a way to offset some of the cost of proposed tax breaks. Coming in at more than 1,100 pages, the bill appears to be teetering at a crucial time. Some Republican lawmakers from high-tax states are also calling for an expanded state and local tax deduction to be part of the package. The Department of Justice is considering dropping a criminal case against Boeing over two fatal crashes of 737 MAX jets. NPR's Joel Rose reports lawyers for family members of the crash victims say they were notified by prosecutors.
The Justice Department is considering a deal that would allow Boeing to avoid criminal prosecution, according to family members of the crash victims. Boeing agreed last year to plead guilty to a single count of conspiracy to defraud regulators about the safety of its planes after the crashes of two 737 MAX jets that killed 346 people. But a federal judge rejected that plea deal. Now, prosecutors under the Trump administration say they are looking to drop the criminal case and push instead for a non-criminal settlement with Boeing that would include about $440 million for a crash victims fund. Lawyers for some of the family members say they are outraged by the, quote, backroom deal and plan to fight it in court. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR. Once it became clear Russian President Vladimir Putin would be a no-show at peace talks with Ukraine and Turkey, the outcome was predetermined. Officials taking part in the discussion say a pair of low-level delegations met for less than 2 hours today. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky had called on Putin to meet face-to-face, but once the offer was rejected, also failed to participate. Zelensky's called for tough sanctions against Moscow if it rejects a full and unconditional ceasefire and an end to the killings. President Trump has said he wants to meet with Putin soon to discuss how to end Russia's war against Ukraine. A transit strike is shutting down commuter rail service across New Jersey today, forcing more than 100,000 riders to find other ways to work. Ramsey Khalife of member station WNYC reports on the disruption.
Riders are scrambling to find the best way to get to and from New York and New Jersey on the first day of a locomotive engineer strike. Thursday night, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen and New Jersey Transit couldn't finalize a deal, sparking one of the state's biggest transportation disruptions in decades. Nerman Ayobola is a professor at the City University of New York who lives in New Jersey. She's a regular commuter rail rider and took a bus instead.
It's much longer. It's uncomfortable. And many people were standing in the bus.
The union and NJ Transit plan to meet with federal labor mediators on Sunday, which means the strike is slated to last through the weekend. For NPR News, I'm Ramzi Khalife in New York.
Stocks gained ground on Wall Street today. The Dow is up 331 points. The Nasdaq rose 98 points. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at Kresge.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. President Trump is reshaping the Middle East very quickly. He's striking deals with many countries and leaving one absolutely stunned. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
When President Trump announced his decision this week to lift sanctions from Syria, Israelis couldn't believe it. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had asked Trump not to lift sanctions, Israeli media widely reported. Former military intelligence chief Tamir Haiman on Israeli Army Radio said Trump's move totally surprised Israel. He said it didn't come with any promises of strategic gains between Syria and Israel. Consider these other recent deals without Israel at the table. A U.S. truce with the Houthi rebels in Yemen, with no Houthi commitment to stop attacking Israel. A U.S. hostage deal with Hamas, with no Hamas commitment to release the other Israeli hostages. A U.S. arms deal with Saudi Arabia, with no Saudi commitment to open ties with Israel. The one regional deal President Trump has not been able to land is a Gaza ceasefire. Dan Shapiro is a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and former U.S. ambassador to Israel.
There are signs that Trump actually just wants a deal to end the war. And so when he sees opportunities to make progress on other matters, he's not going to be delayed by Netanyahu's well-known foot-dragging. And Israelis are understandably unnerved by this approach from President Trump, which is quite different from his approach toward Israel in his first term.
During Trump's first term in office, he tipped the scales in Israel's favor and away from Palestinians in all kinds of diplomatic gestures. When Trump returned to the White House this year, Netanyahu was the first world leader to visit him.
I deeply value your friendship.
But then Netanyahu was summoned to the White House again last month, and Trump made a surprise announcement Netanyahu did not want to hear.
We're dealing with the Iranians. We have a very big meeting on Saturday. And we're dealing with them directly.
Netanyahu wanted Trump to support a military strike on Iran, but Trump has been pursuing a diplomatic deal over its nuclear program. Former Ambassador Shapiro says this is the one deal that could lead Israel and the U.S. to a major crossroads.
Israel has always defined a deal that lets Iran continue the right to enrich uranium, and especially given how the program has advanced in recent years, as an existential threat that might require Israel to act on its own militarily. Israel would really find it very difficult to act on its own militarily if the United States opposed it, but that could be a major breaking point between the two countries.
Shapiro says Netanyahu used to be able to play U.S. politics and build a pressure campaign against presidents he clashed with. But he says today, no Republicans or Democrats are able or willing to confront Trump. Former Israeli intelligence officer Eldad Shavit says Israeli officials must be worried now.
The main reason why they are worried is because they really don't have a leverage on the United States not to go with an agreement that President Trump wants. And Israel cannot do anything today, even more than in the past, because we cannot criticize Trump administration.
After a glitzy blitz of deal-making with wealthy Gulf Arab countries, Trump left the region without a stop in Israel and without a deal resolving Israel's biggest crises. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
The Rubik's Cube, you know, that multicolored cube that scrambled our brains for decades? Well, that has been unscrambled in a new record time. A team of undergraduate students at Purdue University can solve it faster than you can blink, literally. That is, with some help from their new robot. Matthew Patrohey joins us now. He's the team lead on this student project, the Purdubik's Cube, get it? And today is his graduation day. Happy graduation, Matthew, and congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. It is my graduation day, which is pretty fun.
Well, you know, I grew up in the 1980s, well before you were even born. And my brother, he got a Rubik's Cube for Christmas one year. And I remember how much it frustrated me. Like, I could never solve it. I still can't solve it. I don't even try anymore because the hopelessness of it just overwhelms me. So I'm curious, like, what is your origin story with the Rubik's Cube? Why did you become fascinated with this project?
I have a similar story. Back in all the way in fourth grade was when I first kind of was introduced to the Rubik's Cube. And there was a competition, and you get a prize if you could solve it. And I could never solve it, and I wanted to win the prize. So a few friends and I tried to learn how to solve it, and that's kind of how I started with the Rubik's Cube. And then in high school, I saw someone built a robot that can solve it in what used to be the world record, a team of engineers at MIT. And I thought, hey, someday I should try and beat that, and here I am.
I mean, it's pretty amazing. I watched the video of your robot solving the Rubik's Cube. So let me just describe it for people. You have this machine, and it's holding on to the cube like a human would with its two hands. And the cube, it starts out all scrambled up, but then you just push some button on this robot, and it's like, shloop, the entire cube like snaps into perfection. It is literally faster than a human being can blink. It's like a little more than a tenth of a second that this robot can solve the cube, right? Does it just blow your mind even as you watch it today?
Oh, absolutely. It's hard to comprehend.
I barely like register that the cube is solved when I'm watching the video because it happens so instantaneously.
Yes, yes. And it's loud as well, by the way, in person. Like sometimes if you like press the button before you like were planning it, it's very, it's sudden.
Yeah, there's a lot of force provided by the robot, which I understand is why you had to reinforce the Rubik's Cube so it wouldn't like blow up or explode into different pieces. What were some other obstacles you had to overcome to get this robot to solve the cube so quickly, record time?
One issue that we had is that these turns are happening so quickly that it's hard to align them. So a lot of times it'll overshoot or undershoot. Right. So you have to really carefully tune the motion to perfectly align it.
Yeah.
And then once the turn is complete, we want to start the next turn as soon as possible. And if anything, we actually start the motion of the next turn ever so slightly before the previous motion was complete. And tuning that timing took a lot of optimization.
Oh my God. Because yeah, if you think about it, all the rows and columns on the cube have to be aligned, you would think, for it to spin
exactly,
around in multiple directions. So cool. Okay, well, obviously it is graduation day today. What future puzzles await you personally? Like, what's next? Besides trash talking MIT and telling them that you
outbeat them. Oh, absolutely. I love trash talk MIT as a Purdue University student. But yeah. I have a job lined up after I graduate here. And then we're also going to go, my girlfriend and I, on a little trip out to Europe, which will be really fun as well. So
that sounds like a beautiful plan. Matthew Patrohey, by day's end, he will be a graduate of Purdue University. Congratulations and good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you.
For the past 80 years, the U.S. dollar has been the world's reserve currency. Central banks everywhere hold dollars in reserve as a way to safely store wealth. Countries, businesses, and people use it to trade. And when financial markets tank, people rush toward the dollar for safety. But recently, it's looked like that might be changing. NPR's Mary Childs from the Planet Money podcast has more.
In the wake of President Trump's big tariff announcements on April 2nd, U.S. stocks, U.S. bonds, and the U.S. dollar all lost value. That's unusual. Investors seem to be fleeing the U.S., which raised the question, is the reign of the U.S. dollar ending? And if so, what could take its place? Ishwar Prasad at Cornell University told me a reserve currency has to have four features to appeal to central bankers.
One is liquidity, meaning that they should be able to buy and sell that asset easily and in large quantities without disrupting the market.
And he said, number two, it should be safe. It should hold value. Number three?
A reserve currency issuer needs to have the trust of foreign investors.
Things like checks and balances, so they can feel confident the government isn't going to spend recklessly or skip out on its debt. And number four, ideally, its economy is growing.
What we are seeing right now is that every element of the institutional framework, the checks and balances, the rule of law, the independence of the central bank, all of these are being shredded by Trump. So there is a question, is the world going to say enough? We don't trust as much in the dollar as we did before. It's time to move on.
I asked him if any of the other major currencies could meet the criteria. The UK's pound sterling? Nope. Sluggish economic growth. Japan? Same issue. Australia? Canada? South Korea? India? Their markets are all too small. I asked about the euro. Any countries under one common currency? Surely it's big enough?
To put it mildly, it's a mess.
Because all those countries have their own budgets and policies. The market is fragmented, and the market for just the safest ones is too small. Lastly, the other obvious candidate, the world's other biggest economy, China.
People are worried about the state of the Chinese economy, and they don't necessarily trust the Chinese government.
Central bankers and foreign investors worry China will change its rules and they won't be able to get their money out, despite China's promises. I also asked about gold and Bitcoin. Those markets are also too small and Bitcoin too volatile for central banks to buy and hold in reserve. I asked him if he thought central bankers could find a replacement for the U.S. dollar.
They would love to. The difficulty is that there really is no other place to turn.
So he thinks the dollar will remain dominant, but less so. In fact, the dollar is already in decline. The percentage of reserve currencies held by central banks in dollars has been drifting lower and lower. It peaked at 73% in 2001. It is now 58%. Economists expect that to continue. The Trump administration's policies just accelerated it. Mary Childs, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The U.S. Supreme Court has temporarily blocked the Trump administration from deporting a group of immigrants in Texas under the Alien Enemies Act. The rare wartime power was invoked by the Trump administration to quickly deport Venezuelans that it deems are members of a criminal organization. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran is joining us now from Texas. Hi, Sergio.
Hey, Elsa.
Okay, so what did the majority of the Supreme Court say exactly in this ruling?
Yeah, so the court says the Trump administration did not give people at a detention center in northern Texas enough time to challenge their deportations under the Alien Enemies Act. Now, the unsigned order says detainees are entitled to more notice than the roughly 24 hours the government gave the Venezuelan men at the center of this case. Now, it's important to note, Elsa, that conservative justices Samuel Alito and Clarence Thomas dissented. The court was also clear that today's ruling did not address the question of whether Trump's invocation of the Alien Enemies Act was legal.
Okay, interesting. What else stands out to you as someone who's followed this case so closely?
Yeah, I mean, I think this ruling makes it clear that the Supreme Court is paying attention and keeping track of the Trump administration's actions when it comes to quick removals. Many of the cases related to removals under the Alien Enemies Act and even under other circumstances have questioned whether the Trump administration has violated due process. And the Supreme Court today mentioned one of those cases, that of Kilmar Abrego Garcia. He's a Maryland man the Trump administration says was mistakenly deported to El Salvador. That's despite a 2019 order prohibiting the U.S. government from removing him to the country specifically. Now, the Trump administration has said it can't bring Abrego Garcia back because he's now under the jurisdiction of El Salvador and claims he's a gang member and back in El Salvador where he belongs. The Supreme Court pointed at that case and basically said it does not want to lose jurisdiction of if people are flown out of the country in the blink of an eye and while the courts resolve some outstanding issues. It said, quote, the detainees' interests at stake are accordingly particularly weighty. The court also said, quote, we have long held that no person shall be removed from the United States without opportunity at some time to be heard.
Okay, so do we know what is next for this case here?
Yeah, the Supreme Court says this order is meant to preserve its jurisdiction over the case. And this is while the lower courts make a decision on how much time or notice should be given to migrants subject of removal under the Alien Enemies Act. But for now, the Venezuelan men in northern Texas will remain in the U.S. The court did say also that this order does not stop the government from removing people from the U.S. under other lawful authorities.
I mean, Sergio, this all seems like a setback for President Trump, right? How has the administration reacted to this latest news from the court?
So we have reached out to the Department of Homeland Security for comment, but we have yet to hear from the agency. Now, shortly after the Supreme Court order came down, President Trump posted on Truth Social, quote, the Supreme Court won't allow us to get criminals out of our country, end quote. I mean, he's clearly frustrated, right? This is a significant loss for him. Remember, he's pledged to remove millions of migrants without legal status from the U.S., and the Alien Enemies Act is one of the tools he's using. He's already removed more than 100 Venezuelans under this law, and they've been sent to El Salvador, not even their home countries. And there are still unresolved questions, right? The big one is whether the use of the Alien Enemies Act is legal or not. And that's a question the courts and potentially the Supreme Court will have to answer at some point.
That is NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran. Thank you so much, Sergio.
You're welcome.
President Trump's Department of Justice is investigating Washington State over a new child abuse law that it calls anti-Catholic. That law adds clergy to the list of people who must report child abuse. The list already includes people like teachers, nurses, and cops. It's pretty common in many states for clergy to be included, but Washington's new law does something else that is less common. It requires clergy to report information they learn in confession. Member station KUOW's Jeannie Lindsay reports.
Earlier this month, Washington State's Democratic Governor Bob Ferguson, who is Catholic, signed the new bill into law.
For me, this is very clear, very clear legislation and important legislation.
But several Catholic church leaders across the country have condemned the new law, raising concerns about what they see as a violation of the sacrament of confession and their fellow Catholics' constitutional rights to freely exercise their religion. The law doesn't specify confession. It just says that privileged communication is not exempt. But Catholic leaders say that it still puts priests in an impossible situation.
And the priest who does tell somebody else what has been said in confession is automatically excommunicated from his lifelong vocation in the Catholic Church.
That's Jean Hill, executive director for the Washington State Catholic Conference.
So our priests are not going to be able to comply.
Washington isn't the only state that demands clergy report child abuse without exceptions. New Hampshire and West Virginia are among a handful of states with similar policies that have been in place for years. And those laws haven't resulted in priests being put in jail for failing to report. That's according to David Lebon, president of the National Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. He says going after mandatory reporters who fail to report is difficult, even more so with priests.
Without any written document, any video, almost impossible to prove what did the victim tell the person at that point.
The main benefits of child abuse reporting laws, he says, are increased awareness among mandatory reporters, and if a case ever goes to court, the reports themselves are very useful.
It helps us prove and helps us corroborate that the event occurred when the defense is trying to say that the victim, quote, made this up.
Child abuse prevention advocates also say the issue is much bigger than the Catholic Church. Maureen O'Hardin advocated for Washington's new law and was raised as a Jehovah's Witness. He says that religion requires confidential internal investigations around what they perceive as serious sin. And they've argued in court that what's said in those investigations are exempt from mandatory reporting under the same laws that exempt confession.
Opening this up because of the Catholic faith to give this specific exemption for the Catholics has run-on effects, and a lot of other religions will take advantage of this to not report.
It's ultimately unclear what comes next. The Justice Department said in a press release that an infringement on religious freedom, quote, cannot stand. But the department had no comment about whether it plans to investigate other states with similar policies or if a lawsuit is coming to challenge Washington's law. The state's Catholic Conference director, Jean Hill, says she's wary of federal intervention in state law.
My hope would be that the state would amend the bill to read as we had hoped all along, that it would say clergy are mandatory reporters with the exception of confidential communication.
But that's unlikely. The Washington legislature has adjourned for the year, and the governor has already given the law his signature of approval. The new reporting rules take effect in July. For NPR News, I'm Jeannie Lindsay in Olympia. This is NPR News.
The Canton Fair, held in southern China, is the biggest trade show in the world.
If it's made in China, you can get it there. Hair dryers, headphones, hard hats, tools, tractors, yarn, everything.
We hear about the whiplash of running a business during a trade war, as well as the whiplash of covering China as a journalist. I'm Scott Detrow. I'll chat with NPR's China correspondent, John Ruich, and All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Hey, Elsa, ever watch a flamingo eat?
Yeah, they stomp around, bob their heads. They look super weird.
Turns out there's a reason why.
That's one of the great things about science. There's always mysteries waiting to be solved. And with birds as bizarre as flamingos, there's probably more than average.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. On Capitol Hill, President Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill hit a roadblock today in the House Budget Committee. NPR's Tamara Keith has reaction from the White House.
Fiscal conservatives on this key committee are balking at the bill, but this isn't the end of the story. Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt said the White House will continue to have conversations over the weekend to strongly urge House Republicans to support the bill, describing it as a generational opportunity. Leavitt added that the White House expects all Republicans to vote for this bill. This bill is the main legislative vehicle for President Trump's agenda, including big tax cuts and cuts to spending on programs including Medicaid and food assistance for the poor. In an earlier social media post, Trump demanded unity and said, quote, "We don't need grandstanders in the Republican Party." Tamara Keith, NPR News.
A Georgia hospital is keeping a woman declared brain dead on life support because she's pregnant. The family says the hospital required it because of the state's strict abortion ban. Melissa Fado of member station WABE in Atlanta has more.
Doctors put 30-year-old Adriana Smith on life support in February in order to allow the fetus to grow enough to be delivered. Smith went to the hospital for intense headaches over 3 months ago and was eventually found to have clots in her brain. Emory University Hospital declared her brain dead. She is currently 21 weeks pregnant, meaning removing her breathing tubes would kill the fetus. Abortion in Georgia is banned after 6 weeks, roughly the time when cardiac activity begins. Emory Healthcare says the decision was made from a consensus of clinical experts, medical literature, and legal guidance, but the family is upset they did not have a say in whether she should be kept on life support. For NPR News, I'm Melissa Fado in Atlanta.
And you're listening to NPR News. Ukraine has unveiled a first-of-its-kind sea drone used to shoot down Russian fighter jets earlier this month. NPR's Joanna Kakissis has more from Kyiv.
In a nondescript conference room, Ukraine's military intelligence turned up an industrial metal song and unveiled two large sea drones. The Magura 5-7 drones resemble small speedboats, but they're equipped with missiles and machine guns. They're piloted by an elite unit called Group 13. Members wore balaclavas and sunglasses to hide their identities for security reasons, and they had their voices mechanically distorted while they spoke at a press conference. The unit's commander, whose military call sign is 13th, said Ukraine must keep adapting drones to stay ahead of the Russians. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
Federal health officials have given approval to the first blood test that can help diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The FDA cleared the test for patients 55 years and older who are showing early signs of the memory-destroying disease. The test will aid doctors in determining whether a patient's memory problems are due to Alzheimer's or some other medical condition that causes cognitive difficulties, helping identify patients who may benefit from drug treatments. I'm Duane Brown. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Raymond James,
a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. And from Subaru, the new Forester Hybrid offers symmetrical all-wheel drive and up to 581 miles per tank, part of the new Forester Hybrid family of SUVs. More at Subaru.com/ForesterHybrid. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Two major sneaker sellers decided to make it a pair. Giant athletic retailer Dick's Sporting Goods is buying the mall staple Foot Locker for $2.4 billion. And this has many investors and shoppers saying, wait, really? NPR's Alina Selyukh explains.
It's never a great sign when you announce your big news and the people most invested in your success kind of go, you're doing what?
It was definitely a surprise when it came out.
That's Christina Fernandez, an analyst at Telsey Advisory Group. Her take was common on Wall Street. Dick's share price tumbled on the news. Because here's the confusing thing. Foot Locker has not been doing well. And Dick's Sporting Goods has. It's now the largest sports retail chain in the U.S.
Dick's has become a very big player. I mean, Foot Locker at one time was even bigger. They've definitely scaled down, but Dick's has opened a lot of stores. Their stores are very high volume.
They've been growing on their own and actually stealing sales from Foot Locker already. But instead of beating the struggling rival, Dick's Sporting Goods decided to pick him up and put him on its own team. Executive Chairman Ed Stack kept being asked why on a call with investors.
We're pretty conservative. We don't get over our skis. And we took a long time to think about this.
And found numerous reasons in favor. For example, Foot Locker has 2,400 stores in 20 countries. Dick's is a U.S. chain that wants global reach, says CEO Lauren Hobart.
This transaction meaningfully expands Dick's presence internationally for the first time.
That's one reason. The bigger one,
they do cater to a different consumer.
Analyst Christina Fernandez again.
Dick's, you know, suburban, off mall, really catering more to that young athlete and families. Foot Locker is really an urban, indoor mall retailer catering to like a multicultural consumer and a consumer that really cares about sneakers, but from like a kind of cultural, more fashion sense. Like think about like the true sneakerhead.
Foot Locker's biggest brand is Nike, which is also just the biggest one out there. In fact, together, Dick's and Foot Locker will have a much bigger bite of the Nike market, which is actually on the verge of launching a whole bunch of new designs. Dick's chairman, Stack, talks about bringing in not only more shoes, but also clothes.
We've seen the pipeline coming with Nike. We couldn't be more excited to lean into Nike.
But the two companies will also face big challenges, namely the chaos of tariffs. A lot of footwear is imported, putting the retailers on the hook for big new costs. And big brands these days love to sell shoes directly to shoppers through their own swanky apps. Retail stores have to compete with them, too. Foot Locker has been staging a turnaround, and it still made $8 billion in sales last year, which means Dick's Sporting Goods did get a great deal on its purchase. And on that, even the skeptics seem to agree. Alina Selyukh, NPR News.
The head of Venezuela's opposition is calling for a boycott of regional elections this month. It's a way to protest against the country's authoritarian leader, Nicolas Maduro, amid evidence that he stole last year's presidential election. But the call for an electoral boycott has deeply divided the opposition, as well as one of Venezuela's most prominent political families. John Otis has more.
Turnout was massive in Venezuela's presidential election last July. Although opposition leader Maria Corina Machado was banned from running, her stand-in candidate, Edmundo González, won by a landslide, according to voter tally sheets. However, President Maduro refused to give up power. González fled overseas as security forces arrested thousands of protesters. Machado, the opposition leader, remains in Venezuela, but she's in hiding.
Hasta que ese resultado no entre en vigor.
And unlike last year, when she convinced millions of Venezuelans to vote, she's now urging them, through videos on social media to stay home during elections for the National Assembly and state governors on May 25th.
Ir a votar una y otra vez sin que se respeten los resultados no es defender el voto.
Until Maduro recognizes that the opposition won last year's election, she says, taking part in another round of voting would only legitimize Maduro's regime. One politician endorsing the boycott is Juan Pablo Huanipa, a former opposition congressman.
Puede ser perseguida y puede ser encarcelada.
Amid Maduro's crackdown on dissent, he says Venezuelans who vote for the opposition could be tossed in jail. He adds, you can't ask people to go to their own sacrifice. The Huanipa family has itself paid a huge price for getting involved in politics.
Y yo estoy en la clandestinidad. Esa es la situación.
Fearing arrest, Juan Pablo Huanipa says he's gone into hiding. His brother, Pedro Huanipa, who worked for the opposition mayor in the city of Maracaibo, was detained in September.
Ese financiamiento asciende al monto de 6,000.
That's Pedro Huanipa in a video from prison in which, according to relatives, his captors forced him to confess to corruption charges.
Pero nada.
Pedro Juanipa's wife, Carol Figueiredo, says she's been unable to visit him in prison or even talk to him on the phone. Yet, for all the pain and agony, Figueiredo plans to vote in this month's elections. She says that's what her husband, as well as many other opposition politicians, believe is the correct strategy. They also complain that Machado, the opposition leader, called for a boycott without consulting them.
No darles en bandeja de plata.
Figueiredo adds that past electoral boycotts backfired because they simply surrendered more power to the Maduro regime. To avoid such an outcome, a third Juanipa brother is out on the campaign trail holding town hall meetings. Tomás Juanipa is a former legislator who's running for his old seat in the National Assembly.
En dictadura, el voto es un mecanismo de resistencia.
Under a dictatorship, voting is a method of resistance and protest, he says. It shows that you are not surrendering, that you are still fighting. David Smildy, a Venezuela scholar at Tulane University, points out that even when elections are deeply unfair, there can be surprises. He points out that in Chile in 1988 and Nicaragua in 1990, upset victories by the opposition helped those nations transition to democracy.
That doesn't mean that every election you win that the government is then suddenly going to give over power. But it's like playing soccer, you know? It's like you got to get the ball in the area and get it in front of the goal. And then, you know, one time out of 10, you're actually going to get that goal.
Others say the opposition should use this month's balloting as a warm-up for a battle with much higher stakes, a voter referendum on the Constitution that could happen later this year. Maduro wants to rewrite the Magna Carta to make Venezuela even more like totalitarian Cuba, says political analyst Eugenio Martinez.
Se avanza en la reforma constitucional.
And unless the opposition mobilizes to block these changes, Martinez says, elections of Venezuela may no longer matter. For NPR News, I'm John Otis.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Comedian Wanda Sykes is on the road again for her new tour. It's called Please and Thank You. She told my colleague Rachel Martin why she loves to perform in front of an audience.
There's so much going on that I know people, they need to hear what I have to say or... I mean, I know that sounds like very like self-absorbed, but you know what? Yeah, they do.
Wanda Sykes has had a life defined by one act of courage after another, from quitting her job to pursue comedy, to getting divorced and coming out as gay, to surviving breast cancer. On this week's episode of Wild Card with Rachel Martin, she talked about how each chapter of her life has made her stand up stronger.
When did it feel like the career you wanted was in reach?
I'm going to say after the I'ma Be Me special. So that was 2009.
And why did that feel pivotal? What changed after that?
It was like elevated. You know, I felt like I moved up. And The comedy was stronger. I was very open, talking about, you know, being out and been married and kids. But I also talked about, you know, what was happening in politics and all. So it, to me, it just, it felt, it was very liberating for me to just be that open on stage.
Be yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's a couple decades of not really feeling like you'd made it.
Well, I shouldn't say like I had made it, because I think I, yeah, I had
That's a different
TV
question.
Shows.
You're right. It's a different question.
Yeah, I had a TV show.
Feeling like you're making it in the career you wanted.
Yeah, right. You're this was the career I wanted. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So you had been super successful, but it is different to get what you want.
Right.
Like the career that you wanted sounds like was to be able to be your whole self on stage. And there's a there's a element of vulnerability in that too. And you got to be at a certain point, a certain age. Is that part of it too?
That totally it. Yeah, yeah, that's it. And that, hey, if there's not another TV show, you know, your own show, sitcom or whatever that comes along, I'm okay with it. Because I like where I am right now on this stage. Mm-hmm. And if I just continue to tour and do this, I'm fortunate. I'm happy.
Yeah.
You know, so it was at that moment, at that special where I felt that.
The year you've identified, 2009, in that special, that was like not that long after you did come out publicly.
Right.
So was there any part of you that had wished maybe you would kind of rip that Band-Aid off earlier in terms of like some big public acknowledgement?
No, I believe things happen when they're supposed to happen. I probably wasn't ready. You know, I probably wasn't ready to handle if whatever backlash would, you know, that would have happened. But when I did it was when I was ready.
You can watch that full conversation by following Wildcard with Rachel Martin on YouTube. Wanda Sykes is on the road for her new Please and Thank You tour now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Flamingos are some of the most iconic birds on Earth. But if you've ever noticed, they act really oddly when they are eating. Well, now, a team of scientists has unraveled the mystery of how flamingos snack. And NPR's Jeff Brumfield takes a bite of the story.
Flamingos are graceful-looking birds, but come dinner time, they do something really silly. This video is of some flamingos feeding at the San Diego Zoo. They're stomping their little feet and dipping their heads in the water almost between their legs. They kind of chatter with their big L-shaped bill, then they pull their head out and do it all over again. I mean, what the heck is even going on?
Flamingos are bizarre.
Stephen Whitfield is director of terrestrial and wetlands conservation at the Audubon Nature Institute in New Orleans. Previously, he was at the Miami Zoo, where he spent a lot of time around flamingos. It turns out they're using their bills as strainers to capture food like shrimp, algae, and seeds.
They're filter feeders, so they're kind of like the bird version of an oyster.
But even if you accept Whitfield's explanation that flamingos are actually flying pink oysters, it still doesn't explain why they're stomping around and dipping their heads. It just doesn't make sense, says Saad Bamla.
Flamingos are doing everything wrong, it seems like.
Bamla is a biophysicist at Georgia Tech who studies how animals solve problems. To try and learn what flamingos are up to, his group worked with zoos to film them eating. They also did computer modeling and even 3D printed and tested mock-ups of flamingo feet and bills. The results appear in this week's Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And guess what? It turns out flamingos know perfectly well what they're doing, and now so does Bamla's group. For example, that dipping their head in and out of the water, it actually creates a little whirlpool or vortex, and that traps tiny swimming shrimp.
They would basically go straight up from the bottom sediment closer to the top where now the flamingos could, you know, chomp them off and capture them.
Same goes for the stomping feet. It pushes food towards the flamingo's bill while it's underwater, and the bill's chattering also serves to suck up tasty treats off the bottom of the wetlands.
What they're basically doing is playing with fluid dynamics, right? Using the beak, using their legs, using their heads and necks.
Bamla thinks researchers could learn from flamingos. He's interested in how their filtering behavior might apply to water filters. It might be possible to employ some flamingo strategies to keep filters from clogging. For conservation biologist Stephen Whitfield, who wasn't affiliated with the work, the flamingo physics is just pretty cool.
I mean, that's one of the great things about science is that there's always mysteries out there waiting to be solved. And with birds as bizarre as flamingos, there's probably more than average.
Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Since the Final Destination franchise started in 2000, it has pretty much traumatized an entire generation of people. I'm sure you've heard someone reference a scene that still gives them chills. Maybe it had something to do with a log truck. Now, after a 14-year hiatus, we're getting a new Final Destination film. But what is it about the series that's made it stand the test of time? NPR's Erica Ryan has more.
What makes Final Destination scary is unique in horror. You don't see a monster.
That's sort of one of the fundamental building blocks of a Final Destination movie.
There is no slasher in this movie. There is no villain. There is no person in a mask or ghosts in the shadows.
That was Zach Lipofsky and Adam Stein, co-directors of the new movie, Final Destination Bloodlines. Each film follows the same formula. It starts with a main character having a premonition of a terrible accident. In the first film, it's a plane crash. When that person snaps out of it, they race to save people from what they believe is about to, and does, happen.
He said, listen to me. This plane will explode on takeoff. How did you know that?
I got this feeling. This weird feeling.
But it turns out, by surviving, they disrupted Death's plan. And now, it's coming to finish the job, one, by any means necessary.
In death, there are no accidents. No coincidences, no mishaps, and no escapes.
Oh, and it's bloody. Like, really bloody. The series is famous for its kills. Characters end up in a Rube Goldberg-style series of freak accidents, in places that don't seem dangerous. Like a salon, an amusement park, a drive-thru, even a movie theater. As Stein puts it,
the death that comes for you in Final Destination is really death by filmmaking.
And here's Lepofsky.
The ability to kind of have the filmmaking create the feeling of a presence, all in the way that you kind of craft all this tension and delight and humor and suspense, making the audience aware of something that the characters aren't, and kind of building that anticipation is so much fun to do as a filmmaker.
The camera work sort of lets the audience in on a secret. For example, in perhaps the most infamous moment of Final Destination 2, a logging truck is barreling down a highway. Before anything even goes wrong, dread is setting in, because it's alternating shots of massive logs coming unchained with clueless drivers right behind it. Everyday to-dos seem treacherous. Stein says that's part of the point.
The real fear from Final Destination comes from our anxieties. You know, that little nagging voice in your head that says, maybe it's not a good idea to get on that plane.
Final Destination turned 25 this year, and it's become so ingrained in pop culture, it's now its own reference, like in season 3 of HBO's The White Lotus.
This could be some Final Destination like death is coming for me.
After more than a decade, it's a daunting task to revive such an iconic series, but as FD fans themselves, Lepofsky and Stein took on something bigger and bolder. Unlike the rest of the series, the premonition that acts as this film's catalyst actually happened decades before.
I saved a lot of lives that night.
Everyone needs to get off the dance floor!
Lives that were never meant to be saved. But death doesn't like it when you mess with his plans.
The central character manages to fend off her death for decades, meaning her children and grandchildren were never meant to exist.
Death is coming for our family.
The whole series is gory, but the latest film really doesn't hold back. There's one particularly gruesome scene involving a lawnmower. But what is so appealing about gore in movies like Final Destination? Is there some larger societal reason other than people just like seeing blood and guts flying everywhere?
It gives people a chance to sort of purge those feelings that maybe they don't know they're even having about the real world issues.
James Francis is an instructional associate professor at Texas A&M, specializing in horror film studies. According to him, gore is a style, just like anything else, but that appeal probably has to do with scary things happening in the news, too.
They can watch it in a film, either laugh about it, or get frightened by it and deal with that fear.
He says part of it might be morbid curiosity or just fans leaning into the splashy ridiculousness of it all.
They're really interested to see like the makeup effects in movies, how far people will push it in cinema.
Or as co-director Lepofsky says,
gore's back, baby.
Erica Ryan, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Cunard, sailing to destinations worldwide on Queen Mary II, Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, and Queen Anne, with the goals of relaxation, indulgence, and adventure. Learn more at cunard.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate, at progressive.com. Not available in California.